Were you feeling happy being back in Canberra during this time?
I still had a lot of good friends here in Canberra. And I still have my relationship with the Canberra Club where I could always meet and greet, which has always been a comfort to me, I guess, because you get a broad range of not only public servants there, but you do get a lot of the business people as well, a broader scope in the community, which was always good. I pretty soon settled in, really, to two new lifestyle here, and it wasn't all that long before I was able to, and I had three daughters here. I didn't have much to do with my former wife. She didn't want any much to do with me, but the girls did, and that was always a comfort to have their interest and support. And I suppose it wasn't all that long before I got myself married again. Well, got myself involved and subsequently married again. So I wasn't footloose and fancy free for very long.
And I take it that I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but were you thinking this is your future, that you weren't thinking of going back farming?
No, the farming was gone out of my system. No, I'd given that a miss. I'd found it profitable at the time. Well, when I say profitable, I think I might have mentioned earlier that I think I made more net money on the farm than I had as assistant as a assistant secretary in Prime Minister's department. So the return wasn't too bad, and the lifestyle was good. But it always had its ups and downs and difficulties with the weather and the processing, particularly if you're in things like ours with passion fruit, you're dealing with processors, and they were developing means of using ersatz flavourings and things like that, which abolished the need for passion fruit pulp and so on. So I was quite happy to do away with the farming. I'd had that. Done that. It was very good while it happened, but it didn't have to keep happening. No, I was happy to think of Canberra being, where I'll be and stay.
And is it appropriate now to speak about the decline of your time with Ralph Hunt? Did the
Yes.
am I moving too fast or?
No, that sounds fair enough. Well, in if we lead up now to the 83 election, which was called early, which Fraser called early. I don't know. I think it was probably might have been due at the end of the year. But this was well, I mean, Ralph and I were in Victoria, in the Victorian country somewhere, promoting their, oh, I don't know, it was a Bicentennial Roads project or some roads project which was to go over several years. And we were travelling with, I think Batchelor was the Victorian transport minister at the time, and so we were at some centre, and I had a phone call to that the minister had to contact Fraser at a certain time, had to ring him, so we did that. We arranged that. This would have might have been ring at 10 o'clock in the morning or something. So we arranged that, whatever Ralph was doing, and he rang the PM and he said. He said, the PM's called an election. And this was the day that Bob Hawke rolled Bill Hayden for leadership of the ALP. And I think Fraser was hoping to get in while you still had some of this turmoil going on in the ALP leadership area. There was, you know, there were rumours around that, you know, Hawke was getting toey and edgy and so on. And so I think Fraser was trying to jump in before anything happened. And as it happened, the day he called the election was the day that Hawke took over the leadership of the Labor Party. And although he only had the few weeks to present himself as leader of the party, he was able to do that quite successfully. Because he was, would have been different if he wasn't the known figure that he was, I think, in the public mind.
Sure.
So, you know, that was, that turned out to be quite a disaster. But on that day, I mean, for some reason or other, I don't know what was happening, but Fraser had told Ralph to go to Darwin. I think there was an announcement to be made, I don't know if it was about roads or whatever, in Darwin. So we arranged for, at that stage, for, I think this was a time when Tim Conway, who was then the Assistant Private Secretary, to come from Canberra on the VIP flight, which was to take us to Darwin, and bring certain papers down to Ralph. And when he did that, and Ralph had a quick talk to Tim Conway to go and sort of sort out a few things back here and prepare stuff for the election campaign. And he said, well, Frank, you and I are off to Darwin. So, you know, we'd been on a day trip to Victoria, and now we're on a couple of day trips to, away. And at this stage, so I said to Tim, well, when you get back, ring Rosemary, who was my second wife, and just say, I'll be back in 2 days' time. You know, now, this doesn't go down too well with wives, generally. So, you know, when we got to Darwin, the first thing we had to do was get ourselves a toothbrush and comb and, you know, a couple of spare pair of knickers and move on from there. But such is the nature of the game sometimes. Yeah, no, that when the election was lost, then there was a question of, you know, we had a couple of weeks to get out of the office, a few days to get out of the office and sort it out and clean it up and so on and get rid of, pack up files and all that sort of stuff, because we weren't expecting an election at this time, you know, so things just had to be cleaned out in a hurry. I found that that there was other things on my mind too, was getting jobs for this, for the staff, making sure that they were all set up, and for myself, of course. I was particularly conscious of Chris North, who I think I mentioned earlier, that Chris was from the department and he wasn't particularly keen on taking the job in the first place. He certainly hadn't applied for it, because he thought, I mean, he was a Labor supporter, and that didn't bother me, and I didn't tell the minister that, not that it didn't matter. At that stage, the political affiliations, from my experience in Prime Minister's department, didn't count. You know, you did a job and that was it. So after a week, I said to Chris, what if I go and talk to Peter Morris, who was the Labor Shadow Transport Minister and the likely new Minister for Transport. what if I go and talk to Peter Morris and say, offer your services to help him set up his office? So I said, well, that'll, you know, get rid of some of your fears, and also indicate to Peter Morris that, you know, regardless of who you were working for, you can still, you know, set him up all right. And so he took to that, and Peter Morris accepted that as well. And I think that was a good, reasonable sort of thing to do to make the transition as easy as possible. And also from the departmental point of view, because Chris is a departmental officer. Now, I don't know how long he stayed in that position, but... and then I... Jenny Doyle was going to stay on with Ralph as his, well, as his secretary. He was entitled to one. And Tim Conway, I think, got himself a job as with ACIL, ACIL, I think it was, a consulting firm. And Margot Girl, who was extremely competent stenographer, had no trouble getting work. I think she might have gone to Attorney General's department or something like that. But, you know, I was the only one then left swinging. I asked the Ray Taylor, who was head of the transport department, if there's any chance of a job in the department, and he said, well, I'll get Bill Harris, who was his first assistant secretary, to we'll look after that and see what can be done. And I'd had a brush with Bill Harris just before Christmas, about October or November before then, when on this roads program that we were promoting. And Bill Harris had advised the minister on some promotional exercise, advised the minister to take a plane trip somewhere for to get some photographs taken to promote this development of the road program. And when I saw this, it was going to take 4 or 5 hours there and back on the particular day, to which I saw as just a photo opportunity. And I said to the minister, look, there's plenty of roadworks going on around Canberra. Why can't, and we've got more press photographers in Canberra, why can't we just go out to one of the roadworks here and get you on a grader or whatever? I mean, a picture's a picture, as far as this sort of publicity is concerned. Anyway, the minister agreed. And when it was found that this was at my suggestion, Bill Harris was not happy. Ray Taylor was not happy. Ray Taylor's approach was, Bill Harris is my senior officer in this area. If he advises the minister something, that's the best advice. I expect that advice to be taken. So I was not in the good books at the top level of the department. And when it came to the Christmas party, which the minister generally had drinks with the senior staffers, fairly common practice with ministers and senior officers of the department. Come Christmas time, after we had a few drinks and a bit of a chat, and the minister was giving his talk about, you know, how pleased he was at how well the officers, senior officers, had worked and advised him and so on over the year, and, you know, everything was going well. But he said, I think I've got to make a point that I have my own staff here, my personal staff, and they have a particular job to do and particular roles to play. And I think it's important that my personal staff, as well as the departmental staff, it's recognised that my personal staff have a right to have their say as well. and I will make a judgment. And of course, I had a couple of red faces there in the crowd who knew just who he was pointing to. So when it came, 5 or 6 months later, and I was looking for a job, Bill Harris did come up with a proposition. It was a class 5, which was, cutting me down from a class 11. And it was in personnel, where I'd never worked in my life. In all my Canberra career, I'd never worked in personnel. And he said, well, I've got a class 5 in personnel. I said, oh, come on. You're not fit income. He said, well, it's a job and you can move from there. But I said, I never worked in person. He said, if I suggest anything higher, the Public Service Board might think it's a political appointment or something. I said, oh, go on. I said, no, forget it. I'll go. I'll find something. And so I went trying to find something. I suppose initially, I should say that after the election, one of the first things that the new PM, Bob Hawke, had said was there'll be no jobs for the boys. The day after the election, I had an application form ready, which I'd sent to a number of the people that had been sort of shadow ministers who I thought would be ministers, or whether Hawke had immediately announced his ministry, it would have done. So I sent letters to several, 5 or 6 ministers that I reckon, or people who would be ministers, that I reckon I could work with. People like, well, Mick Young, I knew Mick Young. Everyone had a beer with Mick Young in the Canberra Club. So Mick Young was one. John Kerrin, Dick Klugman, I think Peter Morris. We had a pretty good working relationship, there were several of the ones that I'd particularly applied to. But within a couple of days, the Prime Minister announced that no jobs for the boys, but I'm going to set up a ministerial staff advisory committee. Bill Butler was the chairman of that committee. Peter Walensky was another member of the committee. And they were to check the staff, check the applicants. And there were adverts in the papers as well for staff. So my applications then went on to this committee. But I didn't rate an interview. Now this was a committee looking at senior private secretaries, and assistant private secretaries. So you're looking at something like 70 or 80 positions. And at the time I felt that I was probably the second most parliamentary staffer in Canberra. I think Paul Davey from Doug Anthony's office would have had more experience than I had in this area, but not sort of the breadth of experience that I'd had. But I thought, oh, so much for no jobs for the boys, I didn't rate an interview. So when I had this response back from the committee, Bill Butler said, your application is, I have to advise your application has not been successful. There were 2,000 applicants or something like that, and other people were considered to have more experience and qualifications for the job than you have. I went to the Discrimination Commission. I wrote to the Anti-Discrimination, whatever they call themselves, Commission, the chairman there. And the response back, after a long a long period of time. They just, and a number of probably 8 or 10 telephone discussions and personal discussions with them. All they did was ask Bill Butler, you know, why it appeared I've been discriminated against on, as I said, on political grounds, on supposed political grounds, because I'd never been asked my political affiliations in my life here in Canberra, in any of the jobs I'd held. And he simply wrote back that Mr. Jennings, other people had more qualifications for the job than Mr. Jennings. And that was it. And the Discrimination Commission just accepted that and forwarded that on to me, and that was it. Mm-hmm. But, well, when I say that was it, there were some changes. I mean, the minister did, the minister for state did announce that there would be changes in how appointments were made in the future. But that didn't help me one little bit. And probably another mistake I made at the time was that when I had this response back, I took a copy of my letter to the Discrimination Commission to Jack Waterford at the Canberra Times. And Jack was a political reporter at that stage, not editor. I said, look, this Jack, I've just... He'd written a story a couple of days before about staffing and so on and at ministerial levels and things. And so I said, look, this is what's going on. But, you know, this is for background, you know. Let's, you know, keep me out of it. But if you're interested in the background, this is what's happening. And the next day, across 5 columns, down 3 inches, Frank Jennings alleges discrimination. Yeah. And, you know, sort of my life in Canberra was dead, virtually. Certainly in terms of government jobs were concerned. But I did apply for several other jobs, and one that I thought I was, well, age was another one that kept throwing up at me. What was I at this stage? 53. And age was one. Overqualified was another. Some of the jobs that I was applying for, politically tainted, you know. So, I thought the Parliament House Construction Authority was advertising for someone at about a class 6 or 7, and this was to do with handling of reports to Parliament and questions in Parliament about the authority. And I thought, and the authority's short term, 5 years, 8 years, or whatever it was, I said, you know, I think it was a 5-year sort of thing at that stage. And I said, well, I've done this from both ends. I've done it from the departmental side, I've done it from the ministerial side, handle all these sort of reports and statements and questions. Age shouldn't count, surely, if it's a 5-year thing. And I didn't write an interview. They appointed a journalist to the job, but I think there are only 2 jobs. I think I applied for, you know, be over 100 jobs, I suppose, around the place, and I had 2 interviews. One was for the Voluntary Health Insurance Group, where Russell Snyder and I were the last 2, and Russell got that and is still there. I see he was on the honours list this year. Mm. And the other one was... for director of the Churchill Memorial Trust, where I was a bit involved with Menzies when he started this up, you know, many years before. But they appointed a, you know, a former Rear Admiral or something like that, into that sort of job. So... I was a bit sunk there.
Do you have any idea as to why you weren't successful in applying for the jobs that were based on the experience you'd had as the private secretaries?
And the you know, I felt I could have worked quite well with a number of them. And, you know, Mick Young, for instance, had no qualms about, you know, taking my application and then passing it on to the committee. People like Dick Klugman and John Kieran knew me to such a degree that if they were making a statement, if they were putting out a press release in their own electorates about transport policy, they'd clear it with me first before they put it out. Mm. They said, well, look, forget any of the political stuff, but is this okay factually? You know, this was on things like Badgery Creek Airport and things like that. So, you know, the working relationship and the respect they had for my capacity there was pretty obvious. I mean, the respect I had from Whitlam was pretty obvious. But I found that, one of Bill Butler's comments on the Ministerial Advisory Committee was that I'd only applied for a senior position, and he read that as being just a senior private secretary. Subsequently, I got the guidelines that that committee was working on in terms of how they would assess people in for the senior private secretary, and assistant private secretary. And for the senior private secretary, they would, one of the factors that they would take into account was their party affiliations. Now, I didn't apply simply for the senior private secretary position, and quite frankly, I couldn't see why party affiliations had, which branch you belonged to, or what your association had been with the Labor Party had anything to do with your administrative capacity to handle that sort of work. I understand that when there was a first draft of an application form drawn up, it had a question in it, which branch of the party did you belong to, which was put quickly rubbed out. I could only assume that was assumed political affiliation.
Can you tell me the source for that previous statement you made about the first draft that was rejected?
No, I don't know that. I don't know the source of that. But it might have been just talk in the club.
Right, yeah.
But certainly the fact that when the committee are making their recommendations to various ministers about some of the applicants, that the party bit, party connection, was to be included in terms of senior private secretaries. I've got that on a document I got from Special Minister of State Department at the time.
That in itself is a big shift within the political culture, isn't it, compared to what had happened
previously.
Previous career.
Absolutely. I mean, it would have been, you know, the first time that, you know, you had to be a party member sort of thing to get an administrative job. Now, unless they didn't see it as an administrative job. But then, as I pictured it at the time, if you're going to have political advisers, like in Yes Minister, you have them in. You don't have them as your senior private secretary or just your private secretary. You bring them in on the side as special advisers. But then, you know, the culture had changed pretty dramatically, and I think I was outed on, you know, false grounds, I think, you know, sort of. I wasn't at all happy.
Did you find your social life was affected in Canberra?
Well, to the extent that while I was still either on a Prime Minister's staff or on Ralph's staff, I might have had 20 or 30 invitations to Christmas parties by lobbyists or, you know, those sort of people. Whereas once the election was over, there was none of that. You know, you think you had a contact with someone on a personal basis, and all of a sudden you felt that you're no use anymore, so you're off the invitation list. Yeah. So to that extent it did. My social life at the Canberra Club didn't change. I would have thought, you know, most of my quite a lot of the people I used to drink with there would have been Labor supporters. I mean, one, for instance, that I had a pretty good connection with was Peter Cullen. And Peter had been a research officer in Whitlam's office. I was quite surprised, actually. I was invited to a surprise 50th birthday party that he had. His family sort of invited me. So, you know, that was fine. And, you know, I had subsequent sort of contacts with Peter, but so, you know, they weren't affected.
Was there an awareness that you had been badly done by?
I don't think people were surprised. I mean, the people that I talked to and so on at the time, I think they expected that the Hawke would change the system and make it more political. But that didn't help me one little bit. And I finished up answering an ad in the Canberra Times which said, "Looking for a new career? Ring such and such a number." And I thought, wonder what on earth this is. Could be anything. Could be a sandwich board carrier. It could be a street walker. It could be anything. Who knows? And it was insurance. So I finished up selling insurance.
Oh, yeah.
Which didn't amuse me one little bit.
No.
But, you know, bread on the table job. So I wasn't a happy boy in 83, as you can imagine.
No, I can. Yes, I can well imagine how that must
be. So, you know, that virtually concluded my association with the old Parliament House. Well, not quite, because even in the insurance, because of my background, come budget time, the sales manager would say, "Frank, will you, when the budget's brought down tonight, I mean tomorrow, will you brief our meeting on where the opportunities are to sell insurance given changes in the budget?" So on budget night, I'd come over to Ralph's office and get a copy of the budget papers, take them back, burn the midnight oil, and then brief the insurance agents on the morning after budget on what opportunities there were in superannuation or whatever. And let's face it, at that stage there were changes in legislation at least once a month.
Yeah.
You know, often there were five or six changes in the budget on superannuation. So there was always something there for the insurance industry, or something to consider.
Yes.
For the insurance industry. So, you know, I did come back and keep for a couple of years getting the budget papers to... I'm a bit reluctant to just necessarily accept what's in the newspapers about budgets or anything else, but so I prefer to get the speech itself and documentation.
Did you ever have dealings again with Jack Waterford?
No. I gave him a miss in a hurry.
Mm.
Yeah. No. I did approach him. To say why immediately, sort of, you know, why'd you do that? When I said, he said, "Well, you know, you might have said that, but I didn't agree that I wouldn't use it or use it as I saw fit." So there was no real agreement as far as he was concerned, which probably helps me now in my current role as tutor for the University of the Third Age, and I tutor on a subject called Behind the Headlines. And I give the media, I do my media watch, and I give people like Jack Waterford hell every now and again. I use them as an example of, you know, why trust a journalist? I know that might sound rough, but I've had enough examples to indicate why there should be a reasonable amount of cynicism and lack of trust.
Did you continue to follow politics once you...
Not to any real degree. Followed a little bit more now that I'm tutoring again. Oh, I did when I went to Melbourne. I went to Melbourne in 94, end of 94, I suppose. It must have been 97, yeah, 90. Again, I got involved in the University of the Third Age in Melbourne as a student for a start for a couple of years. And then in, it would have been 97, 98, as a tutor in current affairs. So I did renew my interest in the political and government administration area. And I used to get a lot of material from Kevin Andrews, who was actually he was my next door neighbour at one stage in Heidelberg. And I used to get material from his office, which I, you know, used a fair bit of, you know, things like, well, things like Bring Them Home report and so on, which I used pretty substantially for a couple of meetings. And I was tutoring there in two different campuses at Doncaster, Templestowe and Yarra Valley. So that started me off on the tutoring bit in current affairs.
What happened after Canberra? Like, can we go back to the chronological sort of order? Or when you
83,
you then sold insurance.
Sold insurance until 94.
Gee, that was quite a long time then.
Well, it was interesting. One of the interesting things in insurance, which probably does affect the whole Parliament House to a degree, is I saw that the government was looking at allowing public servants, or certainly ministerial staffers, to put their superannuation money with a private fund rather than the Commonwealth Super Fund. So I followed this through the Parliament, through the legislation bit, and made a contact with a senior officer in the Department of Finance who was, you know, involved in getting that legislation prepared and through. And so I kept in touch with what was happening there and what changes might be made and so on. And the day the legislation, the bill received royal assent, I had my letters prepared for every member and senator explaining how I could help their staff in terms of their superannuation. And I hand-delivered these the day after the legislation was assented to, hand-delivered them here at Old Parliament House. So I got the jump on a lot of other agents there because of the background knowledge that I'd had of the system.
When you say hand-delivered, do you mean to each office?
No, I hand-delivered to the attendants at the attendance boxes in King's Hall, who, you know, sort of did they then went on the next round. Yes, I got quite a few. So I had more contacts then with some of the staff here in Parliament House in terms of as an insurance agent, and also some of the journos. Actually, I had a couple of journos, a couple that you'd probably know. As Patrick Walters was one of my clients, as was Chris Warren, who was with John Howe, as Social Security Minister at the time.
Brian,
and then
Brian Howe.
And then subsequently he's, you know, sort of secretary of the Journalist Association, and now I think in the international journalist field. Still a very strong figure in that area. I remember I had discussions with her name shouldn't escape me, shouldn't it?
Is she a journalist?
She was at the time in the ABC, and then she worked with
not Gay Davidson.
Not Gay Davidson. No, she's now a member of Parliament for New South Wales for Goulburn. Prue Goward. How could I forget Prue? I talked to Prue Goward about her superannuation when she was still with the ABC, I think, and this was before she went to, I think, Rosemary Follett, but as Chief Minister for the ACT. But Prue and I. And I was one of the first insurance agents to have my photograph on a card, my business card. So I gave this card to Prue. We had a talk, and I said, "Oh, you know, ring you back about this, or we'll talk about this later." And I remember I rang her up once, and she said, "Frank, I get up every morning and I look at your picture on my dressing table." But she said, No, I'm not ready to make any decision yet.
And so from Canberra...
You can't win them all.
Yeah. And after Canberra, you went to Melbourne? Is that the chronology?
Went to Melbourne. I lost a daughter to suicide in 94. And I had a son who had recently married Nicaraguan girl and come back from Nicaragua, where he'd been for 4 or 5 years. And he was with Australian Volunteers Abroad, or Overseas Service Bureau at the time. I'd reached a stage where I just wasn't coping particularly well with life, and particularly when Libby died. And I was living in Queanbeyan for a few years, I came back and lived with my son, my oldest son Alan, and Nicaraguan wife and three little kids, and I became a built-in grandpa. And then when Alan got a job with Overseas Service Bureau in Melbourne, they asked me to go to Melbourne with them, so that's when I went to Melbourne in, would have been the end of 94, and I lived with them until 98. When I then moved to Port Macquarie, when a former girlfriend's second husband died, and I said, "Well, it's about time we got together," so that took me to Port Macquarie, where I still be.
Yes. And you mentioned you're tutoring with the
I'm tutoring now. I was surprised there was no University of the Third Age in Port Macquarie, which is a great place for retirees and for the University of the Third Age. But I did tutor for a little while there with the adult ed on current affairs. But then the University of the Third Age started 3 years ago, and I've been tutoring with them ever since. And you only get a small group, you get 15 or 20, but they're interested, and it stirs the thinking of the oldies, and I think that's important. When they get to my age of 78 now, that it's important to keep their minds active, I think, and that's what one of the things I'm trying to do at the moment. I had one person there in the group who was 95, yeah, and still extremely mentally alert. So, you know, it's a...
You know how we spoke...
Keeps me busy.
We spoke previously about the change in the political culture in your time from Menzies to Hawke.
Mm.
Are there any observations you'd like to offer about how the culture has developed even since then from your perspective?
I think the biggest thing that I find is the influence of the media, and the media are continually trying to get more influence. I mean, you've got it now. You've got, you know, this Well, there's a right to know movement going on and headed by John Hardigan and so on, and pushing the government to make changes to freedom of information laws so that more and more, arguing that the freedom of information laws were really geared for open government so that, you know, the people were allowed to see what was going on behind government decision making. Well, I didn't think that was the idea of the freedom of information laws at all. It was more freedom of information about individuals rather than what was going on. And I can see massive problems if the pressure succeeds and that all sorts of documents are available to the media during consideration and deliberation stages of policy making. I mean, you see it now with ministers making off-the-cuff comments at doorstops and while they're power walking in the streets to journalists who just shoot questions at them or on some of the current affairs programs where ministers and prime ministers are making statements to journalists insisting that they give them a response to a question and specific responses. To me, this leads to bad administration. Off-the-cuff comments that you make and then are publicised and you feel that you can't back off them without being charged with, turning over or whatever the terms they like to use. So I think the media are playing a big role in terms of putting pressure on ministers and to make statements that they shouldn't be making without more serious consideration. I mean, it's one of the reasons why Howard, I think, went to radio in the morning, because journalists weren't reporting the statements that were coming out from the PM's office. So he goes to radio where he's talking directly to people or favourable journalists or interviewers, selected interviewers on particular subjects, and getting his own view across without having it distorted or cut or censored by journalists who just want to make a story out of it. And then once your PM goes on radio as often as Howard did, you then get the press gallery journalists saying, we're not getting a fair crack of the whip. But when they got a fair crack of the whip, they abused it and continue to do so. There are plenty of examples, and I had plenty in my time, which I can use with my group often enough. But I think the media stuff and this support for whistleblowers, this recent case with the fellow from Customs releasing a security report on Sydney Airport, or allegedly releasing the report. I think he still denies it. But, he was involved in the preparation of the report. But the fact that no one did anything about that report for a couple of years, and then when it was released to the press, the government jumped up and down and brought in a bloke from England, a security bloke, and they'd spent $200 million, upgrading security airports. The media use this as a justification for whistleblowers to hand out copies of reports, confidential material. It's not the public servant's material, whether they prepared it or not. I would have thought the more appropriate action would have been to, complain up the line a bit for a start and, see if you can get some action that way. But I find a lot of the whistleblowers have been disgruntled public servants who in some cases probably overrate their position in the establishment when their views have been overlooked by people up the line, and they feel badly done by. And I don't think that's a good enough excuse to blow the whistle and release material to the public. So there is a lot of pressure from the media, and I see even now they're suggesting that the current government should make some changes to the freedom of information laws. Well, I noticed the same's happening in Queensland, that, you know, when Beattie was there as Premier and some journalists wanted some information about some inquiry or something, all they did was brought those files into the Cabinet Office and they became part of... They became cabinet documents and therefore not available for release. Well, it's, you know, gone a bit too far, but I don't think there's any justification for draft materials, advising materials to be made public. The things to be made public are, I think, the final decisions of government and maybe their reasons for it, but that doesn't mean that all the working papers should be made available as well.
What about lobbyists?
Lobbyists?
During your time, was there a noticeable change in terms of the influence or even the number of lobbyists?
I didn't find a lot of lobbyists involved either when I was with PMs or I mean they were. Generally, the lobbyist would ring to try and make an appointment for a new appointment as head of a company or something, or an organisation. But that would generally be a courtesy call and getting to know you sort of type thing. It certainly gives the person an in that I've met the PM or the minister, and I can, you know, if I send a letter, I would expect it to be, you know, considered. I didn't find any undue influence from lobbyists in my time at all.
My impression is that, you know, from the 80s, there was like a professionalisation of lobbying.
And, yes.
Even businesses that would lobby on behalf of people were established. And
Well, certainly I think the lobbying industry did build up during the 80s, and I was sort of... But my association more on a personal sort of basis at Christmas parties, I guess. But there were three or four who, you know, sort of developed pretty substantial businesses around this town. And I think it was since my time that a lot of your organisations, whether they be medical or others like your pharmaceutical or your AMAs and people or general practitioners or whatever, have set up sort of shop here in Canberra, which hadn't happened in my earlier days anyway. So I think all that's developed since my active time here.
And Frank, how do you feel coming back to Old Parliament House?
I think it's a place I think I should come to more often and prowl around. I know the last couple of years I've come here and I've had probably more looks in the last two or three years than I have for the, you know, years since I left. But it's a place I think I should bring my grandkids to more often, to give them a bit of history and develop their interest in this sort of the political and administrative area of government, and I think some of the displays now are, you know, really tremendous, and in terms of setting out the history and the interest, and encouraging kids to be interested, and I think that's a valuable sort of asset.
And one question that I've been asked to include in all the interviews I do, because we're developing what's going to be called a Gallery of Australian Democracy here as a feature of the building after the portrait gallery moves out.
Okay, yeah.
And they're particularly interested in the responses of interviewees to the question of what does democracy mean to you? Now, I'm happy to turn off to have a thought about that if you want to, and we can continue on that question, or if you feel capable of answering off the top of your head, that's good too.
Well, democracy, I guess it means different things to lots of different people. I think the concept that democracy means everybody can have an equal say, and equal say will be heard and considered and acted upon as a bit of fairyland stuff, bit of fantasy. I've thought about this a few times and talked about it at one or two of my groups, well, years ago, but I think there's a quote that says, you know, our democratic system is by no means perfect, but it's the best thing we've got at the moment. I know my son, my eldest son, who was in Nicaragua for about 5 years, felt it was more democratic there, where people like Daniel Ortega would meet a lot of people in Managua in the local showground sort of thing, and they'd all have their say. But when Ortega became president, my son quickly changed his mind and felt that the views of the people didn't count anymore, because although they've had their say, hasn't counted in terms of the decisions. I see democracy probably as a system where everyone is in a position to have a say, and their say can be heard, not necessarily agreed with, but taken into account. You've still got to have people up the top side to make the final decisions. I really can't go along with any concepts that say, well, we can have a consensus on any major issue we should have a referendum. I think that's just take the administration and decision making too far down the democratic track. In terms of reality, I think I encourage any of my people that have got a bleat about what's going on in government. I say, well, look, put a case to your Member of Parliament. And your Member of Parliament, if he gets enough of those bleats, he should take that further up the track, either to the party meeting or to the minister or whatever. So I think it's a pyramid-type democracy, if you like, that just works its way up the line. And if an idea is found to be good enough with a good enough number of people, it's got a chance of being accepted up the top side. I've got no major bleats about our current system in Australia. I do have some problems I have problems with having two parties, two parliaments, your representative parliament, the House of Reps, and your different parliament in the Senate. I have a problem with that in that it's not, the Senate doesn't meet its normal, its original plan of protecting the states. It doesn't operate. It's a party house. And it's also a place, because of the voting system, where a minority, one or two people representing a very small minority of the Australian population, can control the decision making. Now, I don't think that's a good system at all. I mean, there are people that say that, you know, you should just have no parties at all and just have individual members having their say. But if, I mean, experience around, that might sound all right in theory, but experience around the world, look at Italy. You know, I think since the end of the last war, they've had more than one government a year because they're a lot of individual or small minority parties. You can't get decent administration or decent decision making where you've got a lot of individuals to be taken into account to get one or two on side, and often you get a decision that's made that doesn't represent the majority view, but you get a compromise decision which is often leads to very mediocre decision making. Now that all sounds a bit wishy-washy now when I think of it, but that's top of my head stuff.
And I hope you've been satisfied with the interview itself.
Yes, Barry, thanks.
And in closing up, or finishing off, is there anything important that I've neglected to ask, do you think, or any final comments you'd like to make?
I can't think of anything, you know, relating specifically to the old Parliament House and my time here. No doubt when I sit back and listen to them again, there'll be things that I might have found valuable, but at the moment I think we've squeezed what I can think of at the moment anyway. Into the conversation, but it's a valuable exercise and you know, good historical thing, I think, that you've got some of these recordings and for people. I know we've covered a lot more than just around Old Parliament House, but there's a fair bit about Frank per se in that.
Well, we like to know who you are, of course. You know? I mean, it's not just about your interactions here, but in any of the interviews, what we like to know, who were the people who were part of this place, who made it.
Right.
And I think we've achieved that to an extent. And all I can do is thank you very much once again for your cooperation.
Thanks, Barry. Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Okay. Yeah.